Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict's Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bam@Catholicism.org. I can also be found easily on Twitter @Brother_Andre and on Facebook. The topic this evening is True or False Pope. My guest tonight for all three segments is Mr. John Salza, a practicing attorney for over 20 years and a widely acclaimed Catholic apologist, writer, and speaker. He's the author of 11 books on a variety of Catholic subjects, most recently, True or False Pope, a 700-page work which he co-authored with Mr. Robert Sisco. And unlike the normal procedure for Reconquest, Mr. Salza is going to be on all three segments of this and on the subsequent episode of Reconquest, because we have a lot of ground to cover. And what we're going to be talking about is specifically the phenomenon of sedevacantism, which I'll have Mr. Salza explain so that you get less of me and more of our guest. Good evening, Mr. Salza. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening, brother. Thank you for having me.
So why don't we just jump right into the subject? It's a big subject, and you and I kind of talked about it by email ahead of time, and we know we have a lot of ground to cover. So can you tell our listeners what sedevacantism is and what is the root of its error?
Yes, Brother Andre. Sede vacante, from the Latin, you know, sede, seat or chair, vacante, empty or vacant. It's this novel, you know, frankly, novel anti-Catholic thesis, which holds that any Catholic can decide for himself whether the Pope who was elected Pope and presented to and accepted by the Church as such is a true and lawful Pope, just because one personally discerns that he's a heretic. And most claim that the seat has been vacante, vacant, since Pius XII, given the destruction that has occurred within the Church, beginning with the pontificate of John the 23rd. So really, this is an error that was invented in the 1970s as an overreaction to the crisis in the Church. And it's no different in many respects than Protestantism, I mean, because they all have their various different theories about how a pope falls from office, when he does. They all disagree amongst themselves. In fact, many of them have even elected their own popes. And so they would be called conclavist sedevacantists, those who've convened their own conclaves. But, you know, in terms of the root error, I would say, brother, that the root error, which is, you know, private judgment, but it's really the same as what the conservative Catholics, our conservative Catholic friends. That's an exaggerated notion of papal infallibility. And so they have the same major premise, right, that whatever comes from the Pope must be true and good. It must be infallible. But their minor premise is different. The conservatives would say, because all of these reforms and teachings were approved by the Pope, it follows that they must be true and good. Now, the sedevacantists, using the same major premise, have a different minor. Their minor is, because the things that have come out since the council are harmful and erroneous, that they could not have come from a true pope, you see? And so they both make the error of excess. And how to understand this is, their major premise is wrong. Not everything that the pope teaches, that he says that he does, is necessarily true, good, and infallible. The premise has to be qualified to say that when the Pope invokes his infallibility, and that's been clearly defined by the First Vatican Council and those parameters, it is then and only then that he is guaranteed to be giving us the truth, to be giving us what's good and true and infallible. If not, if he does not invoke his infallibility, if he does not meet these parameters, then he is susceptible to error. Doesn't mean that he will necessarily err, but he is susceptible to it. And so we also point out, brother, in the book, and the sedevacantists, we don't believe they knew about this until we published it, but the Fourth Ecumenical Council of Constantinople actually condemned the sedevacantist thesis. by excommunicating whoever would separate from their bishop without a formal judgment of the church. This has been confirmed throughout the church, throughout history. It was most recently confirmed by Pope Benedict XV explicitly in ex quo. And I'll just finish the introduction by pointing also out to the First Vatican Council, who declared that the seat of Peter lasts beyond Peter's death, and the Sede Vacantis will admit that the council at least teaches that. But the council also said that that seat will always have perpetual successors. That is, that the church will always be able to produce a pope, which she has throughout her time. Otherwise, what good is the chair, right? And so the root error, again, is an exaggerated notion of papal infallibility and a denial of what the church has taught concerning both the constant succession of popes that we will have and the fact that Catholics cannot, by their own private judgment, decide who is a true pope and who is not.
Now, the council that you were citing there was Vatican I, right?
That's correct, on the
perpetual succession.
Okay. Yes.
By the way, Benedict the 15th, whom you just named, was one of the greatest canonical minds in the history of the church. Mm-hmm. So, and the Sede Vacantis tend to. I'm sorry. Did you say 15th or 14th?
I said 15th. Yes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. My mistake because I was talking about the 14th.
Uh-huh.
I was going to say the Sede Vacantis often fancy themselves great canonists. So we get the root of the error, private judgment, and also that the church has already anticipated this in a sense, saying that the church herself has to adjudicate this. In your book, you claim that Sede Vacantism violates the church's attributes. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, brother. The church has certain properties. They're permanent qualities. And she has four marks, one holy, Catholic, and apostolic. And she has three attributes which perfect her nature. And they are her infallibility, her indefectibility, and her visibility. And the Sede Vacantis thesis practically denies all three. Certainly, it exaggerates the notion of infallibility. But it also denies the attribute of indefectibility, that the church will exist until the end of time, because Sede Vacantis practically say that the Catholic Church somehow morphed into a new church after the election of John the 23rd, and now we really don't know where it is other than it resides in the hearts and minds of true Catholics. And that gets to this rejection of the notion of visibility. And this is an important thing to understand for Catholics. When we talked about the church being visible, we're referring not just to the fact that it has visible members, because other religions, the false religions, they also have visible members. So material visibility deals with what the senses perceive. Yes, there are certain people, they worship a certain way, but it's the formal visibility that the Sede Vacantis thesis rejects, because formal visibility concerns what the religion is. And we know what the Catholic religion is by understanding that it is a visible social unit constituted by a pope at the top with a hierarchy of bishops, priests, deacons, there's religious, there's laity. And so it's the visible social unit which gives us the formal visibility of the Catholic Church that is a permanent quality that will exist until the end of time. And if you listen to the Sede Vacantis, and we quote from them very directly, they are forced to revert to the Protestant definition of an invisible church with visible members. Why? Because they reject the visible social unit. They deny that formal visibility exists because they deny that the visible social unit exists of a pope with a hierarchy, and hence they're again forced to resort to the Protestant definition, and this is why we say that they reject visibility.
So the visible church can't be a bunch of independent Sede Vacantis chapels, half of which have excommunicated the other half. I mean, because these folks always differ with each other, right?
That's correct, and you can't look at a Sede Vacantis chapel and know that it's Catholic without understanding it in the context of the church proper, which is the pope and the bishops and the hierarchy. And it's that visible social unit that the Sede Vacantis reject because they can't point to where it is.
And Vatican I actually said that the pope, the papacy, was the principle of the church's visibility as well as of her unity, right?
Indeed, and that's why he is at the top of the chain of the visible social unit. And so when you kick out the man at the top of the chain, what do you have left? Well, they've decided that they're not only the see is not only vacant, but the church is vacant. We can almost say that they're ecclesia vacantis, so to speak, mm-hmm. because they reject not just the Pope, but the entire hierarchy.
All right. So it explains the church. It denies the church's attributes. It denies the church's marks. How does it also deny the church the four marks of the church? The one holy.
Yeah, when we say one holy Catholic and apostolic, you know, briefly we can say that the church will always be one in her doctrine, and that means in her infallible dogmas. Okay, and so therefore there will never be a formal rupture within the church. That's not possible because it could only happen if the Pope were to impose a heresy upon the church as a matter of faith. But Christ's promise that the gates of hell will not prevail, he made that promise in the context of the Pope's authority to bind and loose, that is to bind the faithful to what we need to know for our salvation, which is the dogmas of the faith. So while there may be material divisions within the church, and we certainly have this today with the modernist errors that are in the church, that will not destroy the oneness of the church. We've had this before. I mean, we've had the Arian heresy. We've had the Great Western Schism. These were, you know, material divisions that will never destroy the church's oneness. She's holy. Well, she's produced saints after Vatican II, like Padre Pio. She's Catholic. And this is another important point. When we say that the church is Catholic, it means that she not only is Catholic in right, which means she has the ability to spread all over the world, but in fact, she will spread throughout the world. And the theologians refer to this as a moral Catholicity, which means that the Catholic Church will never be reduced to just a few members. That is in her membership. Now, there's a distinction there, brother, as you well know, between church membership and those who have the supernatural virtue of faith, right? I mean, when our Lord said, "When I come, will he find faith?" he was referring to the supernatural virtue of faith. How many have faith? That's known to God alone. But moral Catholicity deals with the truth that the church will always have a visible membership, large members. Whether or not they have divine faith is another question, but it won't be reduced to just a few members, because that would deny Catholicity. And then finally, and I think very damning, is the Sede Vacantis practical rejection of apostolic succession, which means that the church will always have legitimate successors to the apostles. Now, there's a formal and material distinction here as well. When we talk about material succession to the apostles, that is the physical connection that the bishops today have with the apostles. This deals with the power of orders, the power of sanctifying. However, formal succession deals with their jurisdiction, their authority to teach and govern. And the dogma of the church is that the church will always have legitimate bishops with ordinary jurisdiction. And as Pius XII teaches, that ordinary jurisdiction comes from the Pope. That's what distinguishes the Catholic bishops from, let's say, the Eastern schismatics. There may be material succession there, but there's no formal succession because there's no ordinary jurisdiction. That comes from the Pope alone. And if we do not have a Pope and haven't had a Pope since Pius XII, where's the jurisdiction coming from? Where's ordinary jurisdiction? You know, some Sede Vacantis have said, well, there's got to be a bishop in the wood somewhere that was consecrated by Pius XII. Of course, that's an argument of silence. They can't prove it. They would also have to show that such a person was never a member of the new church, that there's a Sede Vacantis bishop somewhere. They can't prove that. But even that, brother, would still violate the mark of Catholicity, right? Because it'd be reducing the church to effectively one prelate.
Yeah, and visibility, too.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say it would deny the attribute of visibility, you know? And so in my discussion with Sede Vacantis, they have to rationalize this by saying, yeah, there must be a Pius XII bishop in chains somewhere in Korea. It's an utter absurdity. It practically denies the teaching of Pius XII that ordinary jurisdiction comes from the Pope. And this is a doctrine that Father Chicata himself has denied. And this is the only way they can get around their practical denial of the apostolic succession.
And the bishops of the Society of St. Pius X are the faithful who worship at chapels like that aren't Sede Vacantis, but are going to bishops that don't have ordinary jurisdiction. They don't buy into this argument of the Sede Vacantis because they well know that ordinary jurisdiction has to come from the Pope.
It absolutely has to come from the Pope, and we've always maintained that prior to the current Pope, you know, giving ordinary jurisdiction to the priests, they were operating under supply jurisdiction, in which case the church supplies, but that's not going to benefit the Sede Vacantis because that only applies to Catholics, and in the objective order anyway. Sede Vacantis would be considered schismatics because they reject the authority of the Pope and those in communion with him. Again, I'm not talking about the subjective level or culpability, but on the objective order, they wouldn't have supply jurisdiction either because they're outside the church.
Yeah, these materially, they're schismatics. I mean, they fit the definition.
Correct.
You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre interviewing my guest, Mr. John Salsa, about True or False Pope, his recent book. So, John, there's a distinction between the internal and the external bonds of unity in the church. The church is one. We'd already talked about the mark of unity. How do the external and internal bonds of unity with the church reveal the errors of Sede Vacantists?
Yeah, we thought that this was important material to cover to provide a foundation for the understanding of where they err when they say that the sin of heresy causes the loss of office. And we go into quite a bit of ecclesiology in our book, Robert and I do. And we note that there are the internal bonds that a man unites himself to the church. Those are the virtues of faith, hope, and charity that reside in the soul. We might say that those internal bonds unite us to metaphorically the soul of the church, right? But there are also external bonds, and the church has been clear what these are. They're the profession of the true faith. They're the participation in the same sacraments, and then thirdly, united to the hierarchy, the Pope and the bishops. So there's a threefold external bond that unites one to the church. And what's critical to note is that perfect observance of these unities is not required for church membership. So one can be in a state of mortal sin, let's say, and still be a member of the church. He's still a member of the body. He may have severed himself from the soul of the church, but he would still be a member of the body. Even an occult heretic, right? Even one who is a formal heretic, that is, he's committed the sin of heresy internally by an act of his will. Even he, although he has severed himself from the soul of the church because he's lost all the virtues of faith, hope, and charity, unless his heresy is public, he remains a member of the church. He remains a member of the body. And hence, you know, those popes who have made heretical statements over the years, those statements alone do not sever themselves from the body. Maybe they've lost the interior virtue of faith. Maybe they're not united to the soul. God knows. But the heretical statements alone do not sever them from the body. It's only according to the church's judgment. And what we thought it was important to qualify is when we talk about the profession of faith, that first external bond, that doesn't mean that every Catholic professes the faith with complete clarity. How many of us have made materially heretical statements, right? I mean, if everybody who made a materially heretical statement was a heretic, the church wouldn't have many members. What the profession of the true faith means is that the person acknowledges the church as the infallible rule of faith. That's the key. So to the extent that these popes have, and they have, acknowledged the church as the infallible rule of faith, their materially heretical statements alone do not sever them from the body.
So would you say that the Sede Vacantis is sort of forced to judge the internal forum of a pope and say he has formally assented to this heresy with his will and therefore excommunicated himself?
Absolutely. And this is what we point out over and over again. The sin of heresy, sin is a matter of the internal form. It's not a matter of the external form unless it becomes public. But then we're talking about not the sin, but the crime. This is the key distinction. Sin is a matter of the internal form, and the church, even the church, doesn't judge internals. And no theologian in the world has ever said that the sin of heresy alone causes the loss of office. In fact, as we'll probably get to, Bellarmine explicitly rejected this opinion in his De Romano Pontifice. So it's a matter of the internal form, and the virtue of faith is not required for membership. Again, it's only when the sin is adjudicated by the church in the external form as criminal And that's when both the material element of heresy and the formal element of heresy, which is the subjective will, the pertinacity, only when that is established by the church in the ecclesiastical form is then the man severed from the body of the church. So there's a distinction there between an individual's private speculations versus the public judgment of the church.
And of course, it would be very difficult. I mean, the standard is set very high. The bar is very high for saying that a pope has pertinaciously resisted Catholic teaching when he is the highest authority in the church.
Yeah, and I would even say, brother, that even the material element is about the highest bar that you have to overcome, because when you're talking about heresy, the Sede Vacantis and even other traditional Catholics, they use that word really loosely. But we have a chapter in our book that talks about all of the lesser theological errors and censures. And most of these errors are not heretical. They fall into a lesser category of error. A heresy is a direct denial or doubt, but it's directly contradictory to an article of the faith, right? So if the Pope would come out and say, there are four persons in the Blessed Trinity, that's, of course, materially heretical. But some of the things that they say, it takes extra steps of reason, you know, to conclude that there's heresy. And in fact, the Sede Vacantist writer himself, John Daly, said that where you require extra steps of reasoning to reach a conclusion that something's heretical, it's going to fall to a degree less than heresy, because it's not a direct denial or doubt. You see, it's only indirect. So that's an important distinction to make. But then, as you said, if a material statement, a heretical statement is made in the public forum, and you still have to judge the subjective element, which is pertinacity. And that's only established after the church establishes that he's been warned and he still perseveres in his error.
All right. I think we're going to end our first segment here. Everyone hold on to after the break, and we'll be joined again by Mr. John Salsa to discuss his book, True or False Pope. Stick around.
You're listening to Reconquest with Brother Andre Marie, seeking that which was lost and fighting for it, exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.